Good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order April 4th, 2022. It is 1:37. With me today is Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Wilson, myself, Stedman, and Senator Bishop is arriving in the parking lot as we speak. And I think Senator Olson is online, maybe? Is he online? Maybe not. We might be calling in. Today on the agenda, we're going to have a review of judgment and claims. We're going to have a presentation from the Department of Law. It's Corey Mills and Stacy Carley. And then we'll also have with us the Division of Legislative Legal, Megan Wallace, who heads that up for us. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and call on the Department of Law to make some opening, introduce themselves, make some opening comments, and we're going to walk through at least 10 issues of varying degrees of concern that different committee members had. And with that, Ms. Mills, you're online. Ms. Corey Mills from the Department of Law.
Hello, Chair Stedman. Can you hear me? This is Corey Mills.
We are waiting for your smiley introduction and to help us through this presentation, please.
Yes, thank you. Sorry, I was on hold at the LIO for the last 15 minutes, so I apologize for my delay. Again, Corey Mills, Deputy Attorney General for the Department of Law for the record, and I apologize that I could not join you there in person. I am in COVID recovery mode and thought it best that I continue to stay away from other people for just a few more days. So today, I understand the topic is judgments and settlements, and so I'm going to start by giving a brief introduction and overview of what our judgments and settlements are, kind of background on the Department of Law, as well as an understanding of a couple of the elements that often come up with these judgments and settlements. And then I was provided, and I believe the committee has before them, a list of particular judgments and settlements that have been of interest this year. And so I plan to briefly cover those as well at the end of my presentation. And then, of course, I'm available for questions at any point, and I'll try to take some pauses for that, or you can wait until the end once I'm through my talking points. So as a starter, I wanted to kind of step back and give context for what these judgments and settlements are. The Department of Law, as I'm sure you know, but the public may not know, you know, we handle thousands of cases at any given time that involve numerous different claims against different state agencies, different state officials. And every year in the supplemental budget, there's a section in that bill for what's called judgments and settlements. And it's really judgments, court judgments, settlements of court cases or pre-litigation settlements, as well as attorney's fees, judgments or settlements reached in cases. And this, the amount listed in the supplemental appropriation is really just a fraction of all of those thousands of cases we're handling in any given year. And it represents those cases or those amounts that don't have an existing fund source. So, for example, at this moment, I just ran the numbers this morning, the Civil Division has 1,352 active cases, that's anything in administrative litigation, superior court, federal court, or our Supreme Court, or any other kind of administrative venue. So some of these cases, some of these 1,300 cases are affirmative cases where the state is a plaintiff seeking some form of damages or recovery or additional taxes. Looking at these types of cases, in fiscal year 2020, the Department of Law's efforts recouped around $2 million in fraudulent Medicaid payments, $52 million in taxes, royalties, and attorney's fees for those natural resource type cases, and then another $5.3 million for consumer protection related cases. Again, these amounts may vary from year to year, but it's just an example of cases where we've gone affirmatively after recovery of money for the state. And then there are cases where the state or one of its agencies or officers is named as a defendant in a case where damages or recoveries or attorney's fees are sought against the state. And of course, when the state loses at least one of those claims, it may be on the hook for some amount of money. As I stated before, many of these cases where the state is a defendant, there's an existing funding source to pay for that judgment, settlement, or attorney's fees. The largest of these is our tort lawsuits. So when you have risk management sit in front of you and talk about a lot of the stuff they do, the cases we're representing the state on in that arena, you know, are generally paid out of those risk management funds. But there are certain cases that don't have an existing fund source to pay for them. And the total amounts for these judgments, settlements, and attorney fees are then put into the supplemental budget for payment in that fiscal year. And then that appropriation ensures that those court obligations or contractual obligations will be paid in a timely manner and not accrue too much interest, because a lot of these court orders do have a certain amount of interest per court rule that accrues over a certain amount of time. So like the amount the state recovers from lawsuits every year that I talked about before, and those vary vastly, so do the amounts in the supplemental for these judgments, settlements, and attorney's fees. And I think you can see this. I think there was a three-year time horizon that was requested by the Senate Finance Committee. And so you'll see that in fiscal year 2020, the total for the supplemental budget for judgments and settlements was around $7 million. The next year, $1.8 million. And then this year, the current amount is closer to $1.1 million. So it can really vary depending on the types of cases, the matters, and what the state's liability is. So one of the questions that has definitely come up this year is, you know, why and what's important about paying these. So many of these are court-ordered payments. They're a judgment that's been issued by a court. But some of them are settlements that may not be precisely court-ordered, but it's a contract that the state has entered into, and any amount to be paid is subject to appropriation. So most cases don't go all the way to trial. Most cases settle in advance. This can save the state resources. It avoids clogging up the court system with unnecessary litigation and also allows the parties to move on more quickly. So if we got into a situation where these settlement amounts, for example, weren't paid, there would be a concern that other parties wouldn't sit down with the state to try to resolve these cases more expeditiously outside of the courtroom instead of more expensively in the courtroom. So, you know, paying these helps us ensure that we can negotiate in good faith with other parties and that they will sit down at the table with us. One of the other areas before I get into the specific cases that I wanted to cover was attorney's fees. When you look at the list of items that have generally been paid for through this judgment and settlement section of the supplemental budget, many of them are attorney's fees. And we've gotten a lot of questions about that, because Alaska is pretty unique in our attorney's fees laws. So most other states actually have both sides bear their own litigation costs, except in certain circumstances. Alaska has for a long time allowed the party that wins the lawsuit to at least get a portion of its attorney's fees, and that portion is generally 20%. However, there are some rules around this that even can expand the amount of attorney fees or detract in certain circumstances. So this can be found in AS 09-60-010, and that statute allows full reasonable attorney fees, not just the 20%, for constitutional claims. There are some exceptions to that, but generally you can get full reasonable attorney fees if the claim has a constitutional basis. That same statute also disallows any collection of attorney fees on behalf of the winning party, like the state, if the claims were constitutional claims and some other factors are met. So what this results in is the state often can't get attorney's fees because there's usually some constitutional claim. So even if we win the majority of the claims or all the claims, the state may still not get attorney's fees. And then in addition, we found that a lot of the claims brought against the state end up having a constitutional basis or some sort of link so that those plaintiffs can try to ensure they will get fees, full reasonable attorney fees if they win. So, and again, you also have the 20% as the minimum. So that's why you see these attorney fees showing up so often in our judgments and settlements, and why they, why they're one common, and two, why the state ends up having to pay them. So the other question that came up before I get to the cases is what do we maybe see coming in the near future on this front? Are there other items that could be added? And I'm not sure if any will be added in this budget cycle, but I did want to name kind of the few that may be on the horizon. To start with, we have the Shelter Cove Road case. And this is a DOT claim involving a road construction project in the Ketchikan area. And the Department of Transportation actually terminated a specific Juno contractor for default. And where we're at now, it's been long in the running, but we're kind of at the point where in May there'll be additional proceedings on damages because the administrative law judge has already determined that the contractor was wrongfully terminated by the department. So we'll have a damages proceeding at that point, and we'll just have to see how that turns out or if it is settled in advance of that. So that's our one big kind of damages case that I'm aware of that's not in the tort context, which, again, are paid more by risk management. There are also, like I said, when it comes to attorney's fees, we have a number of cases before the Alaska Supreme Court currently. You know, depending on which way those cases go, those cases could result in some sort of attorney's fees requirement to be paid. And the ones I could think of were the forward funding case. That's the case we're involved, where the administration and the Alaska legislature are at odds. The effective date clause case is another case where you have the administration and the legislature at odds. And then we have the Higher Education Fund case, which is being briefed, I believe, shortly and before the Alaska Supreme Court. We have the ASEA case involving the unions. And we also have the Flint Hills case, which is about the contamination in that case and against Williams. Where we're trying to get that resolved. The state did win at the lower court level on that, and Williams appealed. So we don't know the outcome of those cases yet, and we'll just have to wait and see what happens in terms of attorney fees on those cases. So now I'm going to move to the specific cases of interest that were listed, unless, Chair, you want to entertain questions now before I get there.
No, I think we're ready. Go ahead and continue.
Okay. So the next set of cases, and I'm just trying to make sure I have the list brought up in the order you have it. So the first item on the list is recall Dunleavy versus the state of Alaska. This amount in the judgments and settlements is for attorney's fees. It was not a damages case. And just to give the background for everyone, as a reminder, this case involved a recall petition that was filed with the Division of Elections. The Division of Elections, based on an opinion from the Attorney General at the time, denied that petition on statutory grounds. And that then made its way all the way up to the Supreme Court. The Superior Court upheld the recall petition except for one item, and then the Supreme Court upheld the Superior Court decision. So then what happened is then the prevailing party sought attorney's fees, and that's what you'll find in the judgments and settlements amount. And I believe this amount is only for the Supreme Court for the appellate fees. The Superior Court fees, I believe, were in last year's judgments and settlements, if I recall correctly.
So can you help us with the numerics of these when you explain them to us?
Oh, yes, absolutely. So for that amount, that is $197,631. That accounts for the specific judgment amount, which is around 190, and then we always have to add on the interest that will be applicable, considering we'll probably pay it, you know, by July 1st. We always add in what that interest will be. Also on this chart, we were asked to put in how much it costs for the department, so we put in our attorney costs for the department. In terms of time and any costs, and that you'll find in, I think it's column 12, so $146,687. That represents what it costs for us to defend the state in that action.
Okay.
Question.
So item number two.
Okay, just a second. We've got a question on item number one. Senator Von Imhoff.
So just, it looks like the total cost is $344,000. Is that correct?
Yes. By adding those up, I do just want to be clear that Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair, that the total J&S cost in column 16, that represents what needs to be appropriated. The total costs represent both the department costs and the attorney's fees judgment costs together, but the department costs, of course, those are paid for through our normal operating budget. So I just want to be clear on what's in what budget. But yes, that is the total cost for what the department paid, as well as what we need to pay in attorney's fees.
And can you help us with what J&S is?
Sorry, J&S stands for judgments and settlements, which is this section of the supplemental bill that we're talking about.
Right. It'd just be easier for those listening at home if we don't use acronyms and just takes a brief minute to spell them out so they can follow along. You have a follow-up, Senator Von Imhoff?
Yes, so thank you. So I see line 16, in essence, or column 16, is the column that the legislature will be considering appropriating to cover this. Is that correct?
Senator Von Imhoff, through the chair, that's correct.
One last question.
Other questions on number one?
Just one last question.
Sure. Go ahead, Senator Von Imhoff.
So thank you. As you go through this, and you may have touched upon this, I was trying to follow along in your opening statements here. Is there a criteria by which the state covers these costs for a state employee, particularly here in the executive branch, versus when the state wouldn't, if there's particular actions or particular aspects of the case where the state wouldn't act as the attorney?
So through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, yes. And I'm happy to address those standards. I was going to do it when we get to kind of items five, okay. I think six and okay. seven, which really have to do with the lawsuits where Governor Dunleavy was named, where this really comes up, Alaska Landmine somewhat so as well. So I can either address that now or wait until I get to those cases.
Just, we'll wait until we walk down in order. Senator okay. Wilkowski.
Thank you. Do you know how many court cases there have been over the definition or the certification of recalls in the state of Alaska prior to this one?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, so from a statewide perspective, for the Alaska Supreme Court, this is only the second case. At the Superior Court, there's been, I'd say, a handful of cases that dealt with recall.
So two cases at the Superior Court, or Supreme Court, correct?
Yes, Chair Stedman, two cases at the Supreme Court. Only one of them actually dealt with a state employee. The other Supreme Court case was actually a, I believe it was municipal.
Okay. Follow up, Senator Wilkowski. Okay, we'll go on to number two.
Okay, item number two. So this is vote yes for Alaska's fair share versus Lieutenant Governor Meyer. And this really dealt with the Division of Elections. And the Lieutenant Governor, for purposes of ballot initiatives, will prepare a summary. And that summary ends up going on it's really the ballot description. And then the question is, you know, do you want this initiative? And in this case, the sponsors for the ballot initiative sued the Lieutenant Governor over that statement, in particular, one sentence that had to do with the Public Records Act. So this ballot initiative was the one on oil and gas taxes that was on the ballot in 2020. And there was a sentence about part of the ballot initiative dealt with the confidentiality of documents or making certain documents not confidential. And there was a sentence about the Public Records Act applying. And the court found that they ended up saying you should strike that sentence, but then also allowed the Lieutenant Governor to institute at least a partial new sentence into the summary. So that went both from Superior Court all the way to Supreme Court. Again, this is not a case dealing with damages. This is in terms of payments within the judgments and settlements and the supplemental budget has to do with the attorney's fees that were owed at the end of the day. So again, I'll go across these columns. Column 12, which is the department's cost, the Department of Law's cost on the case, were $71,428. And then if you go across again to column 16, that's the amount that was sought to be paid in the supplemental budget, and that amount is $78,117. And again, I think this was only for purposes of the I think this was for attorney's fees at the looks like this was Superior Court level, but you'll always have potentially two levels, the appellate court as well as the Superior Court, where attorney's fees are called for. So that's item number two. Are there any questions on that one?
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. This is the second election issue, and I know there are others, but September 18th, 2020, the Anchorage Daily News wrote an article in that where they headlined said that there were more lawsuits have been filed against election officials during the first 2 years of Governor Mike Dunleavy's term than were filed in all 4 years of the administration run by the previous governor. Does that sound accurate?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I'm not familiar with how many cases. I mean, I know of the Stand for Salmon initiative, for example. That was a big one when Governor Walker was governor. But I will say that I wouldn't be surprised based on the fact that the election last time was held during a pandemic, and we got a lot of election cases from that. I think that is what put us over in terms of the amount of election cases that we would normally see. I believe there were at least five cases that stemmed specifically from the pandemic and requests to change the election rules because of the pandemic. The witness signature, for example, that one was successful, but there were a number of others that were not successful. But I would just say that I know we saw an uptick in elections litigation during that time.
And in this particular case, my understanding is that the sponsor of Vote Yes actually contacted the Division of Elections to try to fix their concerns with the language, and Division of Elections refused to work with the sponsor. Is that sound accurate to you?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I believe there were discussions had. Ultimately, this is a decision made by the lieutenant governor. There's no requirement that the sponsor is involved. And the lieutenant governor made his certification decision.
Follow up, Ian.
And I think we'll probably see this as a pattern going forward, but wouldn't it be simpler if you just worked with the sponsor to fix the language instead of costing the state $149,000?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I think it depends on, you know, those are policy choices that have to be made, and we also need to make sure the summary is accurate. In this case, the court held that one sentence needed to be struck, but the remainder of it was fine, and, you know, so it's policy decisions that have to be made in every circumstance.
Yeah, and just to be clear, this wasn't just a little sentence here. The Superior Court judge wrote in his decision that the lieutenant governor, quote, tried to put his finger on the scales, end quote, of the election with the way he wrote the description. Is that what the Superior Court judge said?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I believe that was wording in the Superior Court decision. I'm not sure that translated to the way the Supreme Court categorized it.
Okay, follow up, and then we're going to jump to Senator Monimoff, and we'll come back.
And going forward, does the department or the executive branch, are they willing to change their policies and work with sponsors of initiatives so that we don't have costly litigation that takes up time and energy and money, or are they going to stick with the idea that they're just going to do it the way they want to do it?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I think that's a decision for every administration to make, and I'm not familiar with what has happened in the past, but I assume, you know, this administration, a new administration, I don't know that it was a policy that was in place. I believe every administration and every lieutenant governor and Division of Elections determines how they're going to deal with that issue.
Senator Bonimoff.
Thank you. So, Senator Wilikowski, I think this concept I'm about to say may have played into it, and you'll have to remind me. I think when there is a ballot initiative or a referendum, there needs to be a certain number of signatures. And people stand in front of grocery stores or malls or whatnot for months at a time with clipboards talking to passerbys, and they have the language on a clipboard specifically for the initiative or the referendum. So a person who signs their name, a registered voter, has an opportunity to fully understand what is written in front of them. If the writing, after collecting all the signatures, and the signatures are deemed, are ratified, and then there's a change, then I believe the sponsor of the referendum or initiative has to go and get new signatures if there's new writing in the document, because the signatures, when a person signs, they're under the understanding that this is the writing that they're signing for, the document. So I think that was a contributing factor for this particular situation. Thank you.
I don't know if that's accurate or not.
I don't know.
Ms. Mills, could you help us with that at all? And then we're going to go to Senator Wilkowski.
Chair Stedman, it's been a while since that, but that went very quickly, because I believe the certification decision for the petition was happening pretty close to them only having like 2 months to gather signatures. So they have to print the petition booklets very quickly. I can't recall when the discussions happened versus when they got printed, but all of that has to happen in a very expedited fashion.
Okay. So, Senator Wilkowski, back on number two.
Yeah, not to belabor. The issue was just simply the way that the summary was written on the ballot. It didn't have anything to do with collecting signatures, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. We'll go on to number three.
Yes, and sorry, I should have been clear on that as well, Senator Wilkowski. You are correct that the ultimate court case was about the ballot summary. That same summary usually appears on the petition. There is a petition summary that is required as well. There were slight changes between those, but both of them were initially challenged. Ultimately, the challenge came down to the ballot summary. So number three is Alaska Landmine LLC versus Dunleavy. And this was you'll notice on the side it says which fiscal year. So these ones at the top that I've been discussing, these were all paid, I believe, in last year's judgments and settlements section in the supplemental budget. So these are not ones that decisions are being made now. These are ones where the decision was made last year to pay these. So the Alaska Landmine, this was a case where blogger Jeff Landfield for the Alaska Landmine, he brought a complaint in Superior Court claiming that he was left out of press conferences and that violated his constitutional rights. And ultimately, the case was settled fairly quickly. Mr. Landfield was allowed back into press conferences, and the settlement covered Mr. Landfield's attorney's fees that had been spent to date on that case. So again, if you go to column 12, the department's internal costs were $54,000, and Mr. Landfield's attorney's fees and the amount in the settlement was for $65,789.
So it cost us, total cost is $120,099, is that right?
Chair Stedman, that is correct.
Okay, Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. You said this was resolved quickly, and according to the court decision, it said here Mr. Landfield enjoyed implicit press credentialing and access to the current governor's press conferences beginning January 23, 2019. Defendants then implicitly revoked Mr. Landfield's press credentials in October 2019, absent any explanation. Defendants initially indicated that the removal was an, quote, oversight in response to plaintiff's inquiries. However, the revocation was never remedied or rescinded. Mr. Landfield sent multiple emails for a year asking to be invited, asking for this oversight to be remedied or rescinded. His attorneys then sent letters, and then explained pretty clearly how this was in violation of the law, then was forced to file in state court. The state then removed it to federal court. This in my opinion, appears to have been an avoidable situation. I guess the court was issued a pretty harshly worded decision, Mr. Chairman, where they said the government's position is that plaintiffs are not entitled to due process precisely because the government has not provided due process. A vexing syllogism, if ever there were one. And then they went on to say, it is untenable to assume that a cornerstone of our nation's Bill of Rights could be so impotent that it could be extinguished by simple apathy or indifference. And I'm just curious, why did the administration just, again, not simply resolve this case early on? During the year when emails were being sent, when attorneys were sending letters, why did it take a lawsuit? And then even after the lawsuit was filed, the state took it to federal court. Well, why not just resolve this when the case law is so clear?
So through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, with all due respect, I'm not sure we all agree that the case law was incredibly clear. I think you can find cases on both sides of this issue. However, you know, the court ruled the way it did. In terms of the timing, I meant more from when the complaint was filed and when the Department of Law was brought in. We received, I believe, a demand letter that gave us a week to respond, and it was right around Christmas, and they filed the complaint shortly after that. And I had not recalled that the injunction did go through before we ended up settling the case. But that, in terms of the emails and the administration had a policy, a no-blogger policy at press conferences. That was the line they had drawn, and they determined that they were willing to change that and settled the case. Other than that, I don't have any further comment on it.
Senator Wilikowski.
Well, just to be clear, and this is cited in the judge's decision as well, only after plaintiff initiated the current litigation did defendants articulate that they followed an unwritten no-blogger policy. So the no-blogger policy didn't come into place until after the litigation was filed. Isn't that right?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, that is incorrect. I think there were disagreements over whether he was informed about that policy or not, but it was a policy that the communications office was following.
Okay, follow up, and then we'll go to the next one.
Yeah. I just read directly from the judge's decision, and I guess why didn't the state appeal it if the judge got it wrong?
So through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, first of all, you have to remember the procedural stance of where that case was. I believe it was a preliminary injunction. There's a certain amount of, you're not arguing the facts there at that stage. So we never really got to that point in the case, as I recall. But in terms of appealing the case, you know, it's often a decision that it's more efficient and effective, and if the administration was willing to change its policy and it didn't mind doing that, that a settlement was preferable to taking it all the way through and spending another $200,000 on the case.
Okay, let's go on to number four.
Okay, number four is the Lowell, Karen Lowell. And this was a pre-litigation. So I don't believe litigation had been filed in this case, which is why you don't see a case name. But there was a demand letter that had been served on the state alleging wrongful termination. This was an employee of the Alaska State Council of the Arts, and her position had been eliminated along with the entire council. Under the budget the previous year, I believe this was 2019 or 2018, and then she, when the council received money again, the budget changed and the council got money. I believe there was a veto, and then it came back and they redid, the legislature redid part of the budget, and the governor approved that portion of the budget that time. So the council was reinstated, and Ms. Lowell went to apply again and was denied being hired. And so instead of engaging in litigation on that issue, this, you'll see the department's costs again in column 12 were around $27,300. And then Ms. Lowell ultimately, through the settlement, received $85,000. So for a total, if you add up the two, of around $112,000.
Senator Wilkowski.
What was the reason that Ms. Lowell was not rehired for the council?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I believe that would be a debated point on both sides, and I'm not really going to get into the specifics, partly because I have them all in front of me, and I don't know the full facts of this case.
Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah. According to the documents that I have and the documents that are reported in the press, Ms. Lowell was her supervisor, actually the council's executive director, said that, quote, Ms. Lowell is truly a backbone for the agency, said she was irreplaceable. She was terminated, or rather, there was a veto of eliminating the Arts Council. That was one of the governor's line items. That funding was restored, and when the funding was vetoed, all the employees were laid off. When the funding was restored, then the council immediately rehired the executive director. They immediately rehired Benjamin Brown, the chair of the council board of trustees, and they reached out to the remaining staff, except Ms. Lowell was specifically rejected by the governor's office because of, quote, statements made on social media about the governor. Is that refresh your recollection as to why she was fired?
To the chair, Senator Wilkowski, I believe you're accurately representing what Ms. Lowell alleged.
Okay. You're done? We'll go to the next one. Okay, we'll go to the next one. 15.
Okay, number
five.
Yeah. This was Parker versus Dunleavy, and I'm going to take a moment as we get into these cases to kind of talk about the indemnification and other questions that are a little more relevant when we get to the Blandford case, which is one for payment this year. But I think I'll just start off all these cases by giving this background, if that's okay with the chair.
I'll be fine.
Okay. So these cases, except I'm number six is going to be a little bit of a side trail, but I'm Parker, and number 5, 7, 8 are all kind of in the same category. So I'm going to talk about them together, and then I'll come back and address number 6. So this is a case. All of these cases surround the resignations that were requested at the beginning of this administration by a range of employees, seemingly all partially exempt, I believe, and exempt employees. And that included Ms. Parker, who was an OPA attorney, and then it also included Mr. Blandford and Mr. Belleville, who both worked for the Alaska Psychiatric Institute. At the time, I believe they were both psychiatrists, so in a little bit different positions. And Ms. Parker was terminated, and I believe I was trying to find out. I didn't have the exact information, but I believe she was terminated for the same reasons as Mr. Blandford and Mr. Belleville, and that she did not turn in a resignation letter. It may have been that the way her resignation letter was worded was the issue in this case, Either way, she was terminated. This case was settled, and I'll tell you the amounts, and then I'll get into the indemnification issue. So in terms of the state, this was these were paid for with outside counsel. So outside counsel was representing the state on all of these resignation letter cases. And so the outside counsel fees is what you can find in column 12 here, and that's why it's a little bit higher than a lot of our others. $213,859 is what the outside counsel costs were. And then if you go to the total judgments and settlements, that is the amount that was paid out for the settlement, $75,547. And so if you add up all the costs and the department, the outside counsel contract costs, you get $339,407 for the Parker case. If you go down to the Blanford and Belleville cases, you've got, again, we're the two psychiatrists at Alaska Psychiatric Institute. They did not turn in a letter of resignation, and that was the reason for their termination, was that they didn't turn one in. And they, that, again, ended up costing an outside counsel. Interesting that that's in the wrong column. I don't think the $213,000 is a Department of Law cost. I think that's a contract cost as well. That's $237,000. That's if you look at column 13, the internal department costs were $1,213, which I'm guessing were just different costs we had to pay for the court case. And then those settlement amounts, I would look at both the next two lines, because you have the Blanford and Belleville cases, but they're really connected. So we ended up paying, if I recall, Mr. Blanford, $220,000 and Mr. Belleville, $275,000. So if you add up those kind of two together, the $458,000 and $275,000, you know, that's, you're going to get kind of your total amount, because that was really the same case, just two different plaintiffs that got two different amounts in the settlement. So in terms of these settlements and cases where you have a state official named, I will say that in all of these cases, it was not just Governor Dunleavy or former Chief of Staff Babcock named. The state was named as well. There were 1983, which kind of civil rights claims brought, as well as good faith and fair dealing claims, like contract claims brought against the state. And in Ms. Parker's case, that case was settled, I think, before we had any determinative motions filed or completed. I think we were getting through discovery on that case. But in the Blanford and Belleville matter, there was partial motions for summary judgment that were decided by the court. And what the motions for summary judgment were about was really about the 1983 claims against Governor Dunleavy and former Chief of Staff Babcock, and it was regarding whether their positions, the positions of the API doctors, the Alaska Psychiatric Institute doctors, were considered policymakers. And because if it's a policymaker position, you can pretty much be terminated for any reason. If you are not a policymaker position, then you can be let go, but it there's other kind of standards and a balancing test. It's called the Pickering test that applies. So what the summary judgment motion determined was that these positions were not policymaker positions. And then the second inquiry is, does qualified immunity apply to these individual state officials? and the court determined that qualified immunity, not the Superior Court, the District Court determined that qualified immunity did not apply to these positions. Shortly after that decision was issued, the state, on behalf of Governor Dunleavy and former Chief of Staff Babcock, challenged or appealed the qualified immunity finding. So there was an appeal on the qualified immunity issue. There was a motion for summary judgment procedurally, and then the parties settled the case before we got to damages or before we got to the good faith and fair dealing claim and what all of that would cost and how any of those damages and amounts would be apportioned amongst the parties. So the questions that have arisen in regards to this case are indemnification. At what point does the state indemnify or represent state officials? There is a long-standing Department of Law policy. It was actually initiated by former Attorney General Bruce Vitello, and that is still the memorandum we refer to when looking at these issues. And I'm just trying to bring that up now so I can make sure to enunciate the standard that's used. So in the event that a state official or state employee is sued for damages in a civil action arising out of their employment with the state will provide representation and indemnity for compensatory damages if the events or conduct for which you are being sued, which the state employee is being sued, occurred within the course and scope of their job and their actions did not constitute willful misconduct or gross negligence, recklessness in the performance of their duties. This is used often. We get a number of lawsuits. They usually don't end up necessarily in judgments and settlements because they're, for example, tort lawsuits. But a lot of our employment lawsuits, and you'll see others on the list from fiscal year 2020 and fiscal year 21, involving other employees within other departments. This indemnification has been used for commissioners. It's used often for nurses and doctors that work for the state and are sued in their official capacities. It's correctional officers is another category that often comes up. And so, and this is the standard that's applied. And ultimately, this is a decision by the Attorney General at any given time as to whether it applies and whether the individual should be indemnified and represented by the state. The other thing to point out in this case is in these cases that the state was named. I think there's been a misconception that the state was not named in the lawsuit. The state was named, and there was a claim, a good faith and fair dealing claim, specifically brought against the state. We hadn't gotten there in the litigation, thus, one of the reasons for settling early is to avoid an expensive damages trial for both the state and the state officials. So there was potential liability for the state. And the other misconception that I've heard fairly frequently is that if this amount is not paid, that somehow the current governor and the former chief of staff would be on the hook personally for that amount, and that is nowhere in the settlement agreement. I'm not sure how that would occur unless there was a complete reopening of the matter and a new trial if someone were to try to get it. So I think that covers the most common questions that I've received on these types of cases, but I'm happy to entertain questions.
Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A lot to unpack here. And I guess you talked about Section 1983 claims. I know it's a 140-year-old doctrine or statute. What's the rationale? Maybe you could just explain. I know the chair doesn't like to talk about acronyms. That's sort of an acronym. What is a Section 1983 claim, very briefly, and what's the rationale for it?
I'm not quite sure what you mean by rationale. Are you asking why this federal statute?
Why does the federal government allow Section 1983 claims for damages? What is a Section 1983 claim?
So a Section 1983 claim has to do with the deprivation of civil rights, effectively. So you're mainly looking at some sort of constitutional right where a court determines that right was deprived by some action.
And in the decision by Judge Sedgwick, who's a 30-year judge appointed by George Bush the First, by the way, he wrote and he cited a Supreme Court case, Mullinex versus Luna from 2015, quote, "The doctrine of immunity, of qualified immunity, shields officials from civil liability so long as their conduct does not violate clearly established constitutional rights of which a reasonable person would have known." Do you agree with that statement? Or does the department agree with that statement?
Senator Milikowski, I was not the attorney on this case, so I do not feel comfortable one way or the other citing what the case law is.
Can you follow up?
Yeah, well, that's what the United States Supreme Court has said, and that was reiterated by the court in this case. And then, so what they found was there's this doctrine of qualified immunity. It shields officials from civil liability because clearly we don't want officials getting sued all the time and potentially going bankrupt because of that, having to spend a lot of money. However, the court said a right to sue is clearly established when it has a sufficiently clear foundation in then existing precedent. And then the court went on to say, the First Amendment violation in these circumstances, and this was in the Blanford case, was clearly established and would have been known to any reasonable government official. It is beyond debate, based on Supreme Court precedent, that it is unconstitutional to require non-policymaking employees to signal a commitment to a political agenda in order to retain their jobs. The court went on, the effect is beyond debate here. As noted above, the nature of the demand was political. As a condition to retained employment, employees had to offer a resignation that represented a commitment to serve under a new governor and to support his political agenda. That's what the court found in this case. The court found that there's no qualified immunity when a clear violation of a constitutional right has occurred. And the court found it was very clear. It should have been known. And in fact, 10 legislators sent the governor a letter on November 27th, 2018, saying that these requested resignations were a clear violation of their constitutional rights. Do you recall that? Was that part of the record? Was that considered at all in determining whether or not to have these employees restored to their positions?
Through the chair, Senator Milikowski, as I already stated, we had outside counsel for these cases. I have not reviewed the records. I was not the attorney of record. So all I know is basically what the decisions ultimately held and what the appeal was about and what the appeal points were. But other than that, I have nothing further to add.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Thank you. So the legislature then, for these doctors to get paid, the legislature has to appropriate $200,000 and $275,000, correct?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, correct. I think it's $275,000 and $220,000.
Follow up? So if the legislature does not appropriate this money, do the docs get anything?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, no.
Follow up? So the Department of Law settled with these two doctors, pledging money that you are not in control of, and the legislature has to allocate. And so the Department of Law basically, you know, wipe their hands of the issue and pass it on to the legislature to mop up the mess and to appropriate the money based on some political decisions made by the governor.
So through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, so I can understand characterizing it that way, but I would also go back to the point that the state could have been on the hook for more, potentially, and we would have had to pay through a, court order. In this case, it was a settlement. It was subject to appropriation, so it did not obligate the legislature, but in line with all the historical precedents I'm aware of on these issues, it came to what, it thought was an appropriate settlement to avoid further expense and unnecessary litigation on this issue.
Frank, can you help me with how common this is with our previous governors coming up against a qualified immunity in these types of litigation, and even broader across the other 49 states? Is this a fairly common issue or very, very rare and uncommon?
Chair Stedman, that's a great question, and I haven't been able to do a review of other states. I believe someone in the other body did a Westlaw search and didn't find many occasions, or found occasions where qualified immunity did come up, but not many where the court found similarly to the one in this case. In terms of history in Alaska of, challenges where a governor is named as a state official, that actually happens pretty common. I know of at least two or three cases that are ongoing right now. I think we just got one dismissed. So that occurs. I apologize. Am I answering your question, or did you have something more specific?
Not necessarily. I recognize all governors in all states get litigated. That comes with the territory. The question is, when you come up against qualified immunity, how often does that issue come up? And has it come up, and any other governors in the state of Alaska stepped over that line?
So, Chair Stedman, I'm not aware of other cases where qualified immunity has been found not to apply.
All right. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah. So, just to be clear, particularly in the Blanford case, the governor and the chief of staff were sued in their official capacity and in their individual capacity. And it is rare that an elected official or any public employee is found to have violated someone's constitutional rights in their individual capacity. But that's what the court found here, and they said that it was beyond debate. They said that a couple times, actually, that the action was so clearly political that they took what's really, I think, quite a rare decision to find the governor and the chief of staff personally responsible, which means the state wasn't liable. And so when you talk about the state being potentially liable here, the state was found not liable. The governor and the chief of staff were found personally liable. And yet the state then agreed to settle and pay the governor's and the chief of staff's personal attorney's fees and the governor's and chief of staff's personal liability for settlement here of hundreds of thousands of dollars. And I think that's what's troubling to so many of us, is that the state was found to not owe anything, and the governor and the chief of staff were found personally liable, and yet the state then turned around and paid hundreds of thousands of dollars. And I think that is what is troubling to many Alaskans.
Okay, we're going to have to pick up the pace a little bit here, because do we have any, do you want to make a quick response, Ms. Mills?
Chair Stedman, I don't want to dwell on this too much longer. I do just want to point out there were still claims of good faith and fair dealing that we had not gotten to, and I would recommend that you talk to counsel for the ACLU. I don't think they'd categorize it the same way that Senator Wilikowski just did.
Right. Okay, so let's move on to number six. I think you haven't covered that yet, and then we want to go on to 9 and 10 and be done in 17 minutes.
Perfect. Number six is, this was the case involving the line item veto of the court system by the governor. And I think everyone's aware of that, but there was a certain amount taken off, and there was a comment made in the in the veto forms about the purpose of that related to a Planned Parenthood case. The court ultimately found that that was improper. Again, this is not a case where there were damages involved. It was not a damages case. It was a declaratory relief case where the court basically just said you couldn't do that. And the this amount in the columns that you see represents the attorney fees amount. So again, the Department of Law, you're looking at about $88,000, $89,000 in column 12. And then column 16, you're looking at about the same amount in attorney's fees for the opposing party in that case, so $89,331, for a total of $178,000.
So is this a fairly common item in the budget processes since statehood, or is this uncommon and a first?
So Chair Stedman, I'm not familiar enough with all the vetoes in terms of, you know, when the court system has previously received a veto. I'm just not familiar enough with when that has happened in the past. I'm not aware of another case, however, along these lines.
Right. I don't recall another one either. There's vetoes, but not vetoes specifically tied back to actions by the court. Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. You're right, and this is one which, again, just clearly can't do. You clearly cannot veto another branch because you don't like a decision they make. That's separation of powers. It's not even a close call, and I guess it just sort of makes me wonder when I look at this and I look at some of the other cases. How is the governor being advised? Is he being advised on whether these actions are unconstitutional, or is he just disregarding legal advice, or is he getting advice?
Ms. Mills, you want to help with the advice? That's probably getting a little too close to what you want to talk about, but if you can help Senator Wilikowski with that, we'll go on to number nine.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I just comment that, you know, the reason there's an attorney-client privilege that is confidential is so that candid conversations can happen between counsel and the policymaker. I just can't get into it any further than that.
Quick follow-up, Senator Wilkinson.
Yeah, no, I understand. I certainly understand the attorney general privilege. However, I guess it concerns me that you can claim the attorney-client privilege, and we have to pay the bill, and you know, we have to. And I just hope there's some different policies in place, because I understand the governor has a right to get advice. I'm struggling to figure out as the appropriating body and the body that's responsible for appropriating these millions of dollars in funds that you're now requesting, that you can just pretty much do whatever you want, and then we have to pay for it. That troubles me, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Let's move on to number 9. Yeah, and then 10.
Chair Stedman, so number 9, this, I believe, is the forward appropriation case, the forward funding for education. I'm just making sure I'm on the right one. Yes. And so this case is on appeal before the Alaska Supreme Court currently, so there is currently no attorney fees amount to be paid at the Superior Court level. The Superior Court did find in favor of the legislature on the forward appropriation issue. I think this is fully briefed. We're just waiting for a decision. The department costs in this case were $76,470. But again, no attorney fees or anything will be paid or asked to be paid until the point at which that is concluded and we determine if there's any amounts owed.
Isn't this the case where the governor was going to litigate the legislature and he can't sue the legislature? Can you help me with that?
Chair Stedman, I believe how it came about was you are correct. The governor cannot sue the legislature. So the governor was not stated that he did not believe he could pay, that education amount. And the legislature had not appropriated funds in the previous year. They'd appropriated funds the year before that. Thus the forward appropriation. And then the legislature, I believe, sued the governor and the administration shortly before, and an agreement was settled upon to make sure that the monies could be paid out.
Okay. Follow up, Senator Volkowski, and then Senator Von Emmel.
Yes. I'm very concerned about the policy ramifications if you are to win. I don't think you're going to win. But in this case, you had two different issues. You had the legislature passed a $30 million one-time appropriation outside the funding formula for education, and the governor, we had a new governor, Governor Dunleavy was elected, and he simply refused to pay that money out. I don't understand that the job of the governor is to execute the laws passed by the legislature. You simply cannot not pay out at something that we've appropriated. That's number one. But number two is the forward funding of education. And if you prevail, if the governor prevails and says you can't forward fund education, I think you've just eviscerated capital projects, because what you're saying is we have capital projects and the standard is that they're good for 5 years. You can actually get a reappropriation. If you win this case, capital projects are going to lapse after a year. They're going to lapse before you've even had an opportunity to get them out on the street. This would eviscerate the capital budget process. This would make the governor a monarch or a dictator, because he'd be able to simply pick and choose whatever he wants to spend and not spend, regardless of what the legislature did. I just think this is atrocious public policy, and I guess I'll just leave it at that, Mr. Chair.
Senator Von Imhoff, and then we're going to ask Ms. Megan Wallace to come up, if you would.
Okay, thank you. So this is number 9, Alaska State Legislature versus Dunleavy, and the way I read it here is that the department has spent $76,000 of department money that basically where the court said, in this case, the appropriations were for a public purpose, they authorized expenditure without further appropriation, and they did not directly violate the prohibition of dedication or earmarking a particular revenue source. So the court held up the defense of the legislature and said, yes, this is valid and it needs to be paid. Did I read that correctly?
Ms. Mills?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, that is what the Superior Court held. That issue is on appeal. I also just want to clarify that the capital projects, I just don't want anyone, and the public especially, to have a misconception of these issues. This is about an appropriation that was made on revenue that didn't exist at the time. So for a capital project, you spend money you have now for the next fiscal year. So right now you're budgeting for the next fiscal year and you know what money you're going to have in hand, or you predict it. This was trying to do it a year out from that based on revenue that could come in the future. So I just want to be clear that capital projects, still good for 5 years. You can still do a multi-year appropriation. You can still forward fund. The issue in the case is whether you can forward appropriate revenues that are not in existence within the fiscal year you're budgeting for.
Okay. Come on, but you have a question?
You're good.
Okay. Megan Wallace, if you could hop in the hot seat. We got to do a little bit of cleanup batting here for you. On numbers 5, 7, and 8, we're dealing with litigation against the governor himself. The question, one of the questions was, where's the dividing line between being represented as the governor with the Department of Law and a private citizen? And clearly we've had a past with Troopergate with the previous governor that line was pretty clear, and a lot of the employees of Governor Palin at the time had to deal with the issue personally themselves. The Department of Law was not their attorney. These cases seem to some to be fairly similar in certain regards, but there doesn't seem to be the line crossed. So there's a fundamental question: where is that line, or is the Treasury just exposed to whatever the current Attorney General decides is the line?
For the record, my name is Megan Wallace. I'm the Legal Services Director. Mr. Chairman, with respect to the Department of Law's discretion as to whether or not to represent the governor in a matter that's been filed against the governor, I will kind of defer back to Ms. Mills to go through what analysis goes into in terms of whether or not they'll provide representation at a public expense. But with respect to the specific legislative issues that are before, or that will be before this committee, is most specifically in this instance is whether or not it's appropriate for the state or the legislature to appropriate money to cover the expense of settling this lawsuit. And if the federal court decision was the end of this case, there would really be no question that the state it would not be appropriate for the state to provide the cost to satisfy if it was a judgment, for example, based on the court's decision with respect to the qualified immunity and the court's decision that the governor was not protected with qualified immunity. But as Ms. Mills articulated, the case was under appeal, and so there was not a final decision on the merits by the Ninth Circuit in this matter, or the Supreme Court of the United States. So the Attorney General does have pretty wide discretion by statute, by law, to decide whether or not it's appropriate to settle a case on behalf of the state. In my opinion, the unprecedented nature in terms of, I'm not aware of a case in Alaska where a governor has not been protected, or a court has decided that the court or that the governor is not protected by qualified immunity, and I'm not prepared to say that it's never happened across other 50 states, but it certainly is a rare circumstance. And I think the uniqueness of the issue, this question of whether it's appropriate for the state to settle a lawsuit where a federal court basically said there was no state liability, that the only liability in the case was the personal liability of the governor and the former chief of staff, that there's an open public question in terms of whether use of state funds to resolve that matter is appropriate. I'm not sure how close of a call it would be if, for example, the legislature were to appropriate that money, whether or not someone might challenge the use of public funds for that purpose. That certainly is a risk. But it's also not unprecedented for governments in general to cover judgments and settlements in other cases where qualified immunity has been deemed to not shield the government employee. We generally, it's my understanding that those cases usually are more common amongst police officers or other peace officers, but I think given the uniqueness and unprecedented nature of this relating to the governor, there is some risk of challenge. Some risk. I wouldn't necessarily categorize it as high or and can't predict what the likelihood of success would be on that challenge, but there may be some challenge if that money is appropriated. But the real policy decision for the legislature is that if the legislature doesn't appropriate those funds, it's my understanding that the plaintiffs in that suit will not be compensated as agreed upon with the state.
Senator Bishop.
Yes, Ms. Mills, are you still online?
Yes.
Yes, I've just been unmuted.
Thank you. It's my understanding, I heard you say a little bit earlier on these two cases here on on the doctors, that they agreed to these terms knowing full well it was subject to appropriation. Is that what you said?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, that's correct that the settlement document made the appropriation subject, well, made the amount, the payment of the amount subject to appropriation. That was clearly laid out in the settlement that they signed.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, and then if you could, Ms. Wallace, then help us with number nine, the litigation dealing with appropriation, and as I recall, the beginning of the governor was going to litigate the legislature, and he can't do that. So, could you explain that to the public what that issue is?
Certainly. So, the Alaska Constitution specifically prohibits the governor from filing suit against the legislature, meaning that if the governor and the legislature disagree on a matter, the Constitutional explicitly prohibits the governor from suing the legislature. I think there might be some confusion because there are multiple lawsuits pending relating to disputes between the legislature and the governor. So item number nine on the spreadsheet in front of you correctly describes the forward funding matter that is currently pending before the Alaska Supreme Court that's been fully briefed. We're just waiting for a decision from the Alaska Supreme Court. There's a second matter currently also pending before the Alaska Supreme Court, and that is the Taylor versus Legislative Affairs Agency matter. That matter was initiated by the Attorney General against the Legislative Affairs Agency in the summer of 2021, so last summer, with respect to a dispute between the legislature and the governor with over the effective dates of the operating budget. As you might recall, when the budget was initially passed by the legislature failed to get the vote sufficient to approve the special effective dates of the budget. There was some dispute between the branches of government in terms of the options that the governor potentially had to keep the state of Alaska open without an effective operating budget. And while despite the clear constitutional restriction that the governor cannot sue the legislature, the attorney general then filed suit against the administrative agency for the legislature to attempt to litigate the substance of those claims. The legislature hired outside counsel to represent the Legislative Affairs Agency. I think that there might be some mix-up on the spreadsheet in terms of the departmental costs. The departmental costs in column number nine seems to reflect the departmental costs for the legislature in retaining that outside counsel in that second matter, where, and in that matter, the Legislative Affairs Agency had a ruling in its favor from the Superior Court, which held that under the Alaska Constitution that the lawsuit was prohibited because on its face it was nothing more than a lawsuit filed by the governor against the legislature, and that was prohibited by the Constitution.
Okay. We have any other questions on 9 before we go on to 10? Okay, let's do 10. Ms. Wallace, you might as well stay there. You might be up batting cleanup before we're done again. So, Ms. Mills, could you cover number 10 for us, the final one?
Yes, I'm happy to now that I'm unmuted again. Again, Corey Mills, Deputy Attorney General. For the record, the last item on here involves the Power Cost Equalization Fund litigation that was brought by the Alaska Federation of Natives against the state last summer. And this is another case where you're not seeing any sort of settlement or damages amount. This is an attorney, an amount for attorney's fees. This case involved whether the Power Cost Equalization Fund is subject to the sweep of the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. And the court determined that half of plaintiff's argument was correct, and that half had to do with whether the Power Cost Equalization Fund was in the general fund or not. The court found that it was not, and the state decided not to appeal that case, and that you see the amount of the department costs here. Again, our Department of Law costs $49,685. I apologize. This one was inadvertently left off of our judgments and settlements. It should have been included. And the amount for the attorney's fees is, I just found this out before the hearing, $84,217. That represents 60% of the amount that the plaintiffs were seeking in that case. The judge determined that they should not be awarded their full fees and reduced the amount to 60%.
Yeah, I think, and we have any questions on this one? I think some of the concerns is multiple administrations have always viewed the Power Cost Equalization Fund is non-sweepable, and then there was a political change with this current governor, that his first OMB director, and then they concluded it was sweepable, and they were going to remove the funds out of there. And then that didn't go very well. And then we ended up with the litigation on this sweep, and the Power Cost Equalization Fund then was ruled as non-sweepable. So we ended up spending here at least almost $50,000, frankly, for nothing, a political redefinition of a particular process. And I think some of the members of the legislature find it a little discerning that some of these new opinions are costing us thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars and consuming a lot of time and producing next to nothing but costs and confusion. So there is, I guess, some joy in that power cost equalization now is pretty much settled. But we're still not sure on the sweepability of the statutory budget reserve. That's another issue. We'll sit and watch and see how that plays out because of the language produced by the Department of Law in response to the differing opinions coming out of the administration on that and the legislature. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just curious for the department if they consider this issue resolved, considering that there was only a Superior Court decision and it was not appealed to the Supreme Court.
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, of course, the Power Cuts Equalization Fund will, the state has to adhere to that Superior Court decision. It isn't a binding decision, so if that issue ever reaches the Alaska Supreme Court, I would say on the Higher Education Investment Fund, that is a different case. It deals with the availability of the appropriation, not whether it's in the general fund. So I don't think we'll get a differing determination on that issue from the Alaska Supreme Court, but it could occur in the future, at which point, the administration or the executive branch, whoever is in charge of it at that time, will have to adhere to whatever the court's opinion is on that.
So just to be clear, that because it was not appealed to the Supreme Court, the Superior Court's decision on power cost equalization and the other decisions they made that were not appealed is not a binding decision, correct?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, correct.
Follow up, Senator Monemoff.
Why do we have a Superior Court then?
We can go into that whole structure of the course, but we're out of time, Senator Von Imhoff. But the hearing today, the total we're talking about is $2.1 million of these 10, just 10 cases. So it's a significant amount of money we're dealing with here. And that is why the little red flags are coming up with a lot of members of the legislature. It's getting a little expensive. Do we have any other comments, questions?
Mr. Chairman.
This Mr. Chairman. Mills?
Senator Olson.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One of the questions that I have for this $2.1 million that we've got to deal with out there, maybe this is a question for Ms. Wallace, is that something we can pull out of the governor's budget? So that it comes out of his specific, the money that's dealt over to him?
Senator Olson, we have the governor's budget up in a subcommittee next, and the subcommittee members may or may not want to talk about that. Some of them are sitting here with, that may be a point of discussion.
I was just wondering whether that was has ever happened in the past in order to settle some of these issues that have come up with previous governors or in what the history is behind that.
Yeah. I don't know. Okay, thank you. Do we have any other final questions? Sure. Well, I'd like to thank Corey Mills for coming today, walking us through this, helping us understand all this litigation and costs. I'd also like to thank Ms. Megan Wallace for coming forward today, helping us here again. That concludes the meeting today. Tomorrow morning, 9 a.m., we're going to have Senate Bill 193, Dennis, license and radiological equipment, Senate Bill 193, extend Board of Chiropractic Examiners, Senate Bill 204, hunting permit, tag, auction, raffles, House Bill 85, Financial Institutions Liability, Senate Bill 98, Adult Foster Care for Disabled, Senate Bill 199 or 200, Permanent Fund Dividend. We are adjourned.